Welcome to Dad's on the Air for May the 22nd, 2007. Got an interesting show lined up with Erin Pitsey. She's the founder of the Women's Refuge Movement, set up the first women's refuge in the Western world in the UK in the 1970s. She says she regrets the way the movement has been used against men over the decades, and it's a fascinating interview. We normally do a sort of news roundup in the first 10 minutes, but just first up, if Greg, could you just background Erin Pitsey a bit for those who have never heard of her?
Yes, in 1971, Erin Pitsey opened the first refuge in the world for victims of domestic violence. She was running a small community project in Chiswick, a London suburb, when a woman came in and showed her her bruises. She took this woman home that night, and from then on, her little community centre became the first refuge in the world for all victims of domestic violence. Now, Erin became aware that of the first 100 women who came into the refuge, 62 were as violent, or in some cases, more violent than the men they left behind. Erin believes that violence in interpersonal relationships is a learned pattern of behaviour in early childhood. Some children who are exposed to violence in the hands of their primary carers, usually their mums and dads, internalise the abusive behaviour and thereafter use violence and abuse as a strategy for survival. In the refuge, Erin found that she was facing two different problems. Some women were indeed innocent victims of their partner's violence. They needed refuge, comfort, and legal advice, but very quickly, even if they did return to the violent partner on a few occasions, they walked away from the abuse and went on to create a new non-violent lifestyle. Other women were victims of their own violence. The majority of them had experienced violence and abuse from childhood. They had a history of violent relationships and often had criminal records. They needed not only legal advice and refuge, but also counselling to help them to come to terms with their own abusive background so that they did not continue to return to violent and abusive relationships or replace the violent partner almost immediately with another one, thus condemning their children to years of abuse. Erin writes, "The tragedy for me is that I had a vision whereby people who are infected by dysfunctional and violent parenting could find a place that would give them a chance to learn how to live in peace and harmony. This dream was destroyed along with all my evidence and projects. The feminist movement resolutely refuted any argument that women should be allowed to take responsibility for their choice of relationships. The image of women as victims, as helpless, childish dependents upon brutal men worldwide, has damaged relationships between the sexes. The idea that the family is a danger to women and children has destroyed much of our traditional concepts of marriage. The feminization of the family in Western society has caused men to become outcasts and a source of ridicule in their children's eyes." So Erin is now in her 70s and still living and working in London, and we'll have a pre-recorded interview that we did with her about a week ago on the show shortly.
And that's a fascinating interview with her, absolutely historic interview for us. Just for those who have been following this case, we've been following the Murray Robertson case, the father who disappeared in Tasmania with three of his kids. It was unique, really, in the level of publicity that it attracted. The mother took up with one channel television station, and the father took up with another. I think it's unprecedented, the level of publicity that this particular case has received. And it's very interesting, the timing of it. He was getting his family court ruling at the very same time as the Attorney General was telling all the assembled lawyers of the country that they had reformed, that there were the most significant reforms to family law in the last 30 years. He has now, in the latest development in this case, been arrested and charged under a child-stealing charge. As I understand it, that's a fairly old charge. It's been on the statute books in Queensland for quite some time. He disappeared again. I don't think anyone could quite believe that this was happening. Disappeared again with the three children again. Disappeared when the mother woke up. The three children have been gone from the house. From what I hear, they arranged to meet in a local park, and then he went on from there. It's a very tragic and messy case. He's now in jail facing child stealing charges, and I know that a lot of people that were trying to help him are a bit fed up with the fact that he didn't comply with the law and took his kids. It'll be very interesting to see how a father can actually be charged with stealing his own kids. I mean, you can be charged with breaching a court order, a family court order, but which, of course, are breached every day in their hundreds of thousands. But anyway, another story that we've been following with great interest is Alec Baldwin, the US actor, who, of course, received an enormous amount of coverage from a phone call that he made to his daughter when he was calling her not very nice things, and he was very fed up with the whole situation with Kim Basinger. Stephen Baskerville, who we've had on before, he's Dr. Stephen Baskerville, is the chairman of the Fathers and Children Coalition in America. He's written a piece about this, saying it was not a very nice phone call, but then most of us can recall unpleasant conversations with family members, but how many of us are called on the carpet by the nationwide media, forced to explain our private behaviour and subjected to public debate over whether we should be permitted to keep our children, and then summoned to court? Goes on to say the government appropriation of children is now so out of control, and in fact it's not that uncommon an occurrence. Parents routinely lose their children for less than what Baldwin did, and with neither public debate nor trial by jury. While it may be true that Baldwin is being publicly pilloried because he is a celebrity, the invasion of his private life is far from unique. And Baskerville goes on to say that since when did every parent in America become answerable to the media and the government for what they say to their children? As several commentators have noted, if every parent were to lose their children every time they lose their temper, all the children in America would be parentless. We're going to have, we hope, Stephen Baskerville on the show in a couple of months when young Greg here, our reporter here, is going over to America to attend a conference over there. So that should be very interesting material. He goes on to say, which is more or less where we are headed? You can lose your child for almost anything. As several commentators have noted, all the children in America would be parentless, and that's the way we're heading, whether through involuntary divorce, trumped-up abuse allegations, or the myriad methods exercised by the public education system. The government now has so many ways to seize control of your children without ever proving that you have done anything wrong that it is hardly an exaggeration to say that we have already embarked on a system of communal child-rearing. And he says the circumstances leading Baldwin to lose his composure were created entirely by the fact that he was forcibly separated from his daughter by state officials. What he vented was the frustration of a parent prevented from exercising normal parental authority, whose child had been turned against him with the backing of the state, and who was reduced to parenting through an answering machine. We'll have on next week Dr. Ludwig Lowenstein, who is the author of a new book, Parental Alienation. We've had some very poor programming on this from the state-owned public broadcaster here in Australia, ABC, which basically claim that it's an invented syndrome and that all those nasty men's movement people have invented this syndrome called parental alienation syndrome. Well, many of the world's leading experts disagree with that analysis. We're going to take a short break and we'll come back with the absolutely fascinating interview with Erin Pitsey. We'll be back. We're going to be talking with Erin Pitsey. This is an historic moment for Dads on the Air. Erin Pitsey is a world-renowned specialist on gender issues, a world-renowned commentator. She's written a number of books, including Scream Quietly or The Neighbours Will Hear You, and a very controversial book, Prone to Violence, which caused an enormous uproar when it was first published, and she was picketed by feminists and had a huge outcry against that book. She's also received a huge number of awards over the years and written a large number of articles on the issues that we so often talk about on this radio program, including domestic violence is not a gender issue, the planned destruction of the family, and most recently a very controversial article in the Daily Mail, How Feminists Try to Destroy the Family. Welcome to the show, Erin Pitsey.
Hello.
Very good to have you on.
Thank you.
Gabba, you've just been to Bahrain. I wondered if you could first talk about that. You were opening a domestic violence refuge there.
Yes. What happened is several years ago, I was asked by Shirley Yatim, whose family put the money up for a refuge. Her mother-in-law, who was very well known in the Arab world, she was a very early feminist in the sense that she opened the first club for Bahraini women to meet outside their houses, which was unheard of in those days. When she died, her husband, Hussein, who's a lovely man, decided with the family that what they would like to do, with knowing of the problems in the Arab world, was to open a refuge. So 2 years later, last month, I came back from Bahrain having opened it. The Queen of Bahrain was there, and for the first time, the entire subject of domestic violence was publicly discussed and reported in all the Arab newspapers across the Arab world, because it's the first. And it's an enormously important step forward. I think the thing that consoled me from the very beginning is that because they'd never been brainwashed by the whole feminist movement, there was no attitude of hostility towards men. So I was able to say from the very beginning when I opened the refuge in 1971, and it was the only one of its kind in the world, that I'd said that many of the women coming in were violent themselves or more violent than the men they left. And this was the beginning of this huge split that's overshadowed the movement across the world for the last 36 years.
Have you ever regretted being you're the most famous, I guess, for opening the very first battered woman's refuge in the world. Have you ever kind of wished you hadn't done it or taken a different path?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, I mean, I had this vision of because I came from a violent family, and both my mother and father were violent. Actually, if anything, my mother was a great deal crueler than my father. He was a bully, and we were very frightened of him, but she was the one that actually did the battering, particularly of me, because I looked like him. So I always opened the refuge with a completely open understanding of what domestic violence does to children. The tragedy of it all was at that same time in 71, the women's movement, the feminist movement, had just been imported directly from America, and women across the country leapt onto the barricades, and these were largely Marxist feminists who then said that, well, the enemy wasn't capitalism anymore, the enemy was actually men, the patriarchy. So I knew when I opened the refuge that they would come and try and hijack the whole subject, which they did, because they were enormously highly organized.
It is incredible.
What?
It is incredible here, the amount of money and just the way they dominate the entire debate, the entire public debate.
Well, you see, the trouble was, in those very early days, I was this very, very lone voice saying, hey, hang on, wait a minute, this has nothing to do with domestic violence. This is a feminist movement which is basically hijacking the subject because it's a worthy cause in their term. And also, they wanted the funding because they couldn't get funding as open feminists. But what they have managed to do is to turn it into a billion-dollar industry, which has effectively destroyed family life in the Western world and feminized the courts, the law, everything else in its wake. And the result is that there's millions of men who've been falsely accused, who've lost their children, who've been extradited from their families. And I suppose the major problem I have is, and I've worked with men's groups all over the world, whether it's Canada or America or here or Bermuda, for instance, but men do not get together and organize themselves over emotional issues.
No, they most certainly do not. They tend to crawl off under a rock or into their cave, basically.
Because in a sense, I think this is the first time in the history of the world, men have been so attacked in their emotional lives, they don't actually know how to relate to each other.
No, that's quite possibly true. You must have been an incredibly isolated voice to start off with.
I was, and very frightened a lot of the time. I mean, it got to such a ridiculous pitch that anywhere I spoke, I was picketed, and then people would scream at me while I was speaking, whether it was I was in England or America or wherever. What I'm doing at the moment, I have a blog, and if you type Erin Pitsey into Google and then type This Way to the Revolution, you can follow what I'm saying. Because what was so lonely was that if I tried to explain it to anybody, it was so complicated they would just not listen or just say, you're paranoid. But now I think there's sufficient amount of men who've suffered internationally for them to begin to realize that what I was saying was actually the truth. I opened the refuge. It wasn't supposed to be a refuge. It was supposed to be a small community center for women who were isolated with their children like I was. I was married, but my husband was a television reporter, so I didn't see him very much. A small community center where we could get together and work on the things that were necessary for women in our community. Because that was my version of what I thought feminism should be about, working in harmony with men. But, of course, that was ludicrous. That isn't anything to do with what the feminist movement was about. So what happened was that when that first woman came in, Kathy, and took off her jersey and showed me her bruises, I immediately understood what she said when she said, no one will help me. But I didn't understand her in a sense as an adult. I understood the child. Because I was the child in Montreal, standing in front of a teacher with blood running down my legs from whipping my mother had given me with an ironing cord, saying, please, will you help me? And the teacher looked at me and just said, I don't blame your mother for beating you. You're such a terrible child. And I have since written a memoir called Infernal Child. You can get it on Amazon. And this is the story of what it is like to be a child in a warring family. And the thing that hurt me most is because the women's movement hijacked this entire subject and made it all about women for so many years, no one ever talked until recently about the effect it's having on children.
And the debate really still hasn't switched very much, has it?
Well, no, because it's still, you see, the women in the 71 when I started, the younger women who are now in corridors of power in England, Harriet Harman and Patricia Hewitt, they're all in the government. And so how are we ever going to get anything through? Because their argument is, and even though it's proved wrong, even though we know that within the domestic violence sphere, the violence is about equal, I'm not interested in discussions about how many men hit women or how many women hit men, because it's quite simple. If children are born into violent families, both boys and girls will be infected. Some will transcend. But I believe that boys are far more disadvantaged and destroyed by domestic violence than girls. Girls seem to be a lot more resilient.
Why do you say that?
Well, because simply by taking in, I was taking for a long time over 1,000 mothers and children a year because I had a very huge project. And I was noticing how the difference between the small boys coming in, the children coming in, and the violence, explosive violence of the boys. And although the girls were similarly affected by violence, they handled it far more differently. I don't know why it is, but, you know, what I also noticed, where the father's violent, it's an absolute tragedy. But when the mother's violent, it's catastrophic.
Do you think that perhaps the little girls have an emotional language which enables them to maybe express some of their feelings, whereas the boys maybe bottle it up and then explode? Do you think there may be something there?
I think both things. I think girls are much more likely to analyse what's happening in the family and discuss it with each other and discuss it with adults, whereas boys don't. Boys are. There is a chivalrous gene in boys. They do not discuss. They are very, very loyal, particularly to their mothers.
No matter what that mother does.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
And those boys grow up to be members of parliament and probably judging. The same chivalrous gene is still there.
It's still there, yeah.
Mm.
So you've seen the development of this right the way through from the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, could you ever have imagined way back in the 70s that we would reach the state we are in now?
Well, I suppose I had a premonition of it, because before I opened my little community centre, I had been one of the first people to help set up what I thought the women's movement was going to be about, and how naive was that? I was born in China, in Shanghai. We were captured by the Japanese, and so in a sense, politics of that sort was in my blood, because later, in 49, both my parents were sent to what was then Tianjin, back to China. They were captured by the communists and held under house arrest, and many of the people who were captured with them were tortured, and many were killed. So I had a bird's eye view of what the joys of communism were going to mean to the rest of us. So when I first went to the meetings of the Women's Liberation Movement, which was supposed to be a movement for women and about women, I realized it was nothing. It was just yet one of those many, many fronts to raise money for, in those days, the Marxist Feminist Communist Party. And I remember saying to them, quite cynically, hey, hang on a minute, if I have to call everybody comrade and meet in cells and pay you £3.10, you want me to join the Communist Party? I don't want to join a Communist Party, I want a women's movement. So eventually I got booted out. So I had an inkling of what was going to happen, because I was also aware that in England particularly, the feminist movement didn't really reach down into any part of England. It was really always a sort of very white middle class, educated, university-educated type women, dissatisfied with themselves and dissatisfied with their lives. And it always struck me as quite relevant that Germaine Greer, one of yours...
Yes.
We disowned her a while ago.
Yeah. The American feminists both had fathers who abandoned them and wrote books about it. And, you know, that thing that the movement was based on, which is making the personal political... Well, that to a large extent is what happened. Many of those leaders themselves are seriously flawed people with personality disorders.
And the personal is the political. It can't work both ways, does it?
Well, you can't make, actually, your own unique human experience. You cannot extrapolate that to then include everybody else. If your father, like mine, was a violent bully, it doesn't mean that every man I know is going to be a violent bully. It simply means that he was a product of his own background, which I understand. I'm now nearly 70. I know my mother was horribly abused when her mother died when she was young, and the stepmother was very violent. And so was my grandfather, Thomas Last, who was Canadian. We come from Portland in I think it's near Montreal. And a hideous history of abuse, and my father the same.
We'll have more of Erin Pitsey from the UK very shortly.
Here we are in court today. Rose just took the stand. She's divorcing me for reasons I still don't understand. That dress is showing more of her than I've seen in years, and the stories that she's telling has even got the judge in tears. She's accusing me of hanging out with girls of ill repute, adultery and abandonment, even alcohol abuse. And I just heard my mother shout, "Your Honor, throw the book." And even my attorney just gave me a dirty look. Everything's coming up roses. The house, the car, the kids and all the cash. Everything's coming up roses. And I'll be lucky if I keep the shirt that's on me back. Me head is buried in me hands. The courtroom is adjourned. She got all I ever made and all I'll ever earn. And if I had a handkerchief, I'd break right down and cry. Oh, even Alan Bond, I mean, he got a better deal than mine. Everything's coming up roses. The house, the car, the kids, and all the cash. Everything's coming up roses. And I'll be lucky if I keep the shirt that's on me back. Everything's coming up roses. Here I'll be lucky if I keep the shirt that's on me back. Oh, come on, mate, not me budgie. Come on, have a heart.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
We're talking with Erin Pitsey. She's the author of Prone to Violence. She's on the line from the UK. What is the solution to this? What do you think of the programs that operate in a lot of domestic violence treatment programs and so on?
Well,
do they work?
Basically miss, because they're politically based, they basically miss the entire opportunity to help people come to terms with their past. I mean, the programs, the anger management courses, that as far in England, I can only speak for England, and America and Canada where I've been, basically are there to punish men better. Well, you can't do that.
Yes,
and, of course, there's no recognition that women can be equally complicit in the violence. The treatment programs are useless.
And hundreds, literally hundreds of millions of dollars are poured into these programs.
Absolutely.
And you define them as complete waste of money.
Well, yes, because essentially, to take somebody, let's say, in these days, a violent man, he goes into an anger management program. He is treated as though the origins of his violence are of his own volition, even though we know, and if you're interested, you should read Dr. Bruce Perry's papers. He is a neurobiologist. He works from Houston. He has a huge child development organization there, and he is one of the first ones to talk about the damage done to young children's brains, probably during pregnancy, by domestic violence. And once everybody realizes the responsibility for parents that are violent towards their children, that they actually brain damage them, if not when they're born from birth, then perhaps we have to see where it needs to concentrate. We need to concentrate on in schools, among young people, among young parents, who themselves can safely say, yes, I did come from a violent family. Mm-hmm. I know I have these tendencies. Please, can I have some help?
And if someone is asked for that help now, they get none?
Well, not any help that would... If they're a man, they're simply told, you're violent because you have a Y chromosome. That's according to the feminist theory. All men are violent because of the patriarchy, because they are men. So you're born potentially a rapist, a batterer, and a child abuser.
So even if you go, if your female partner is being physically or emotionally abusive to you, as a man, when you ask for help, even though you're the victim, you're told that you have the problem because you're a man.
Yes, and you know, the tragedy for me is that we, in the end, Chiswick became a huge therapeutic community for women who are violent. And many of the refugees in those days, because they couldn't handle already violent women, would send them to Chiswick. Women who are innocent victims of their partner's violence, battered women, we would send to refuges that were just hostels, which is what most refuges are. Once I lost the refuge and everything was closed down, there was nowhere for violence-prone women to receive any treatment or even to be recognized. All women going into these refuges, which are largely feminist, are told they're victims. It doesn't matter what happens. If she murders a man, she's a victim. If she batters, abuses, and sexually abuses him, she's still a victim. And that is getting us nowhere.
And is this actually harming women themselves by encouraging them to see themselves as victims?
I think it's incredibly damaging, because to not allow someone to tell the truth about how they're feeling, that in order to stay within a refuge she has to maintain a lie, which is that she is a victim, is extremely bad for her mental health. Yes. Mm.
Yeah, it's also bad for her getting out of the place as well, for her future, the cure for the situation. I mean,
yeah.
One of the things that I always note in reading stuff about you is just how violent or how vicious the reactions against you were from the feminist movement. Can you talk a bit about those days?
Well, I think you have to remember it was big money. This was their one chance to create this huge edifice. I mean, it's like a very large, bloated Portuguese man of war floating, you know, those great big jellyfish.
Yeah.
And because one of the things that they saw from the beginning, that they could create this whole new women's, if you like, world, which could exclude men. So all of a sudden, all the university started all their women's studies, books, research projects, money poured in. I remember going to America in, it was 76, I think, or 77, and doing this huge tour and just looking at this huge new world that was going to be women only. The refuges excluded men, and to this day, no men can sit on boards, no men can work in the refuges. It's a completely isolated experience. So I knew that part of the hatred that they had and the rage they had against me is that I threatened the funding.
Because they really, you were really painted as the complete devil of the peace, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it got very violent. Death threats, warnings. It picketed everywhere I went, screamed at. And even now, I mean, you know, I'm still considered a total... In fact, it's quite peaceful because they, in England particularly, they just really brush me out of the whole movement. So I'm not really known for what I do. I just quietly work on my own. I write my blog. I help women and men. I work for many men. In fact, when I went to America, that's where I really... I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I had a refuge there. I ended up in court with men far more than I ever did with women.
So, Aaron, how do you see the way forward in this? We've reached this stage where this debate's entirely one-sided and dominated by politics, basically. And how do you see us moving forward from this? How do you see change...
I don't see it ever happening unless men are willing to work together. And, I mean, you know... I was invited to New Zealand in 78 by the Mental Health Association of New Zealand, and I was supposed to go across to Australia to visit all the refugees. But by the time I got to New Zealand, the refugees in Australia realized what I was going to say, so I was banned from coming across and from all the refugees. So I've never even been to Australia, but certainly other countries like Canada, where I spent 6 weeks traveling that vast country talking to men's groups, I just feel this sense that until men are willing to put down their swords and cooperate with each other to do something about this, we're not going to get very much change.
They're always talking about it, but it doesn't seem to happen.
Well, because men won't... Look at this. After I opened that refuge in Chiswick, I realised I needed to be a refuge for men because I had enough violent women coming in to realise that the problem was not gender-based anyway. So I asked the GLC in those days, if I could have a house for battered men. They gave me a house. It was a beautiful house in North London. The millionaire men who would put their hands in their pockets to help my women and children refused me a penny for each other. Men will not help men.
You certainly see that in this country as well, that a lot of the different groups, they're all arguing very similar things, but they do not work together well.
But don't the women's movement also have all various groups? And
they do, and they have tremendous factions and falling out. But what's so interesting about women is that they will take care of each other. They will actually bury their various battles in order to get on with the movement, whereas men just don't.
Do you think it comes back to that the chivalrous gene again, possibly, that the men are out there, all these male leaders ruling the world, ruling companies, they're out there often looking after women and children, but when asked to look after men.
But looking after each other, that's the bit that really baffles
me. It's almost like it's hardwired into male biology. It seems so intractable.
And to see each other as the enemy.
I always think of them as... pools all in their separate paddocks, and they all want to get out of the paddock, but they'll be buggered if they're going to cooperate to do so.
And the thing is, the losers are their children. That's the thing I can never understand. And the people who do work hard in the movements, the heartbreaking thing for them is they say, you know, yes, and once I've resolved his problem, he goes and I never see him again.
Yeah, that's
right. Whereas in the refuge, 3/4 of the people who worked in the refuge were all women volunteers.
But there's some theories about that, because the way the man... once he goes through the family law system, he is financially and emotionally exhausted at the end of it, and they don't have the energy to actually. There's only a very few that will actually go into groups and actually become active that way. Mm. They're destroyed emotionally and financially in every way.
Well, you know, I think one of the things men really have to look at, the 21st century men, is that they, and I've said this so often to men, they have got to learn not to be so emotionally dependent on the women in their lives. Mm. They really do have to.
Are. Yeah.
And they are. You know, I mean, that's one of the things. For instance, women open, if a woman girlfriend has a problem, a woman will say, come stay with me. If a man's friend has a problem, he doesn't say, come and stay with me. If his wife might, or he'll ask his wife.
He'll say, come and have a drink.
Yeah, there's coming. There isn't this concept that men should care for each other the way women care for everyone.
I think that there is a generational change coming through. I know I'm in my 30s, and I have a number of friends in their 20s. Increasingly, men are, you know, a man's going through a rough patch in his relationship, and he'll call his male friend and say, come round, have a cuppa, and they'll have a chat about it and give each other advice, and it is happening, I think, but it's going to take maybe generations for that to really come about full swing.
We can't wait that long because of the children. I think you know, the other thing too I was saying 36 years ago is we have to understand, in these violence prone relationships, we understand addiction to alcohol. We understand addiction to drugs. We don't really understand addiction to a relationship. And once you begin to think about, which Freud said it years and years ago, he said, one day all emotions will be found in chemicals of the brain. Now, those are the same chemicals of alcohol and drug addiction. We carry those chemicals in our brain, in the endorphins. Now, what will determine your choice of partner is your childhood experiences, the way your brain is actually set up to receive information. And you see perfectly, this is where it works, and it's quite easy to deal with, where a perfectly normal person, by accident, gets involved with a violence-prone person. And once they get help, they can get out without any difficulty because they're not actually addicted to that personality. They're basically fooled into thinking they were something they weren't, and then when the violence starts, they're out of there. The problem is where you find yourself in a totally addictive relationship to somebody you know is a disaster for you, but you cannot leave it alone, and you go back and back and back, and sometimes you go back till you die.
We'll be back with Aaron Pidsey from the UK shortly.
Patriarchal power trip. Everyone knows men deserve to be stereotyped. seen the loss of his children. It's all seen as okay. It's the abnormal men like us who complain. Cause don't you know any man or woman, his mouth is labeled as a redneck from the south. He's a right-wing militant chauvinist pig on a patriarchal power trip. Everyone knows who men deserve to be stereotyped. Everyone knows who men deserve to be stereotyped.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
We're talking with Erin Pitsey. She's one of the world's leading commentators on gender, author of the book Prone to Violence, and most famous for setting up the world's first refuge for battered women in the UK. She's on the line from the UK. There has been here a multi-million dollar domestic violence campaign over the last few months in Australia, in television advertising and newspaper advertising. You cannot these days go to a urinal in the movies without having these posters in front of you as a bloke while you're attending to nature, suggesting that if you're a violent person, contact this number.
If you have friends who are violent, contact this number.
Yeah, but what will happen when you contact the number?
The police will come around and arrest you and take you away as a violent person.
Yeah, I mean, only just recently here in England, and I do quite a lot of public speaking, are the police, because now we've got mandatory arrest. It used to be that whatever happened, the police would pick up the man. Doesn't happen so much now. They do pick up the one that they think. The other day it was a woman and she was carted off.
Right.
I mean, in fact, she was treated far gentler than if it had been the man in custody. But at least here, we're beginning to recognise that women are capable of being violent. And even though it's still saturated with men as the perpetrators, the language has become much more gender neutral because they have to.
This campaign that we've had here in Australia paints the men as perpetrators and as the women as victims completely. There is no variation on that. Do you think those sort of campaigns do more harm than good?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely, because it's a lie apart from anything else. It's a terrible lie.
Yeah.
Mm. You know perfectly well that when you get involved with a woman, unless you know her background and what is likely to happen, you can wake up one morning and find you're involved with a nightmare. And then there's a nightmare of trying to get out of it. Because
absolutely.
You're preaching to the converted here.
A nightmare next to her. She has all sorts of avenues for escape and immediate sympathy and immediate protection.
And support.
But just as likely it's going to be a man. And he is going to get ridiculed, laughed at. Mm. Just like my father was 6'4" and my mother was a traditional 4'9". Nightmare. No one would ever believe what my mother got up to behind the front door. My father was a diplomat, and they travelled all over the world. And they were both totally addicted to each other. Actually, I would say he was completely addicted to her, and she just very cold-bloodedly used him because he had money and influence.
Is there any evidence that these public education campaigns decrease the level of interpersonal violence in the community at all?
Well, no. I mean, obviously they don't, because basically, as long as you have this huge lie that whatever is happening in the family is not happening, because most domestic violence actually is consensual. Both parties are violent. One party may not be physically violent to the other, but in those sort of relationship addiction situations, they don't leave each other. The violence is perpetual. It needs treatment. It needs to come out of the courts where it shouldn't be treated into mental health issues.
What is the research showing then now in this whole debate?
The whole debate is showing that the figures for domestic violence behind the front door, roughly equal, which is what I would expect. Back to the whole concept, if children are exposed to violent parents, both boys and girls are affected. So you would expect to see virtually equal figures anyway, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Erin, your book, Prone to Violence, which was thoroughly boycotted and totally censored by the feminists, what was so objectionable to them?
It's a whole record, and you can find, I put it up online, so you can read it online.
Yes.
The whole thing was because it was a dis- discussion and a description of the work I did within the refuge to help women who were already violent and seeking help. It was the work I did with children. There's a whole children on a chapter on children who kill. It was about women who were already violent, who'd been battered and sexually abused as children, about the prostitutes that came into the refuge, how they too had all... And it caused havoc because it was even-handed.
What was the work? What was your approach with those women? How did you help them? And how is it different to the way that the system now apparently helps women?
Anybody coming to me who isn't capable of making warm, loving relationships needs to actually spend that time going back into the very early memories of when they were first abused, abandoned, and betrayed themselves. And then, with understanding and help, work their way through. So in a sense, they can mend themselves. See, we don't give anybody a second chance. They can come through small mini concentration camps of childhoods. And anything they do thereafter, they're punished for. So it shouldn't be like that.
If a child is in a domestic violence situation or someone listening to this program is a perpetrator or a victim, what do you say to those people? What should they just get out or what?
You can transcend it. I had to. Lots of people do. I mean, not everyone who's come from a violent home goes on to repeat the patterns. We don't even look at that. Because we see this, because we've always seen domestic violence as a huge political issue, we've never looked at it the way it should be looked at. And you know, what you need to do if you're listening and you are suffering and you are aware that you are making violent relationships, is you need to go back and work on yourself. Everybody has to transcend. There's no such thing as perfect parents, you know. We all have to actually, you know, transcend our own childhoods, look at what our parents gave us that was valuable and good, and hold on to that, and throw away the stuff that wasn't. And then make that vow that whatever happens in your life, you will not repeat those patterns on your own children.
And so when you take people into these refuges, what do you do for them?
What happens is, the refuge was a relearning program, if you like, a reparenting program. Chiswick was like a great big unruly family. Mike Dunn, who was a ex-rugger player and ex-priest, he was one of the therapists, and he was a sort of father figure. Phil Pepper was a house mother. She was in her 70s, and she was a grandmother figure. I was the mother figure, and there were loads of aunts and uncles around, and it was a huge project. You came in with your children. There you could be yourself. Yes, if you were violent. Yes, if you had alcohol problems. All of it. You were welcome, and you were loved. And in a way, I mean, I always felt... possibly, in a sense, I could never rehabilitate my own mother, and she died when I was 17 of cancer. But I did recognize that it is possible to rehabilitate if people want to be helped, and people did want to be helped. That was a thing so many of the women would just say, I'm so glad I can tell you what happens.
Of course, one of the problems is today that the current system eliminates... the father, who, like the mother, they both want to protect their children. But yeah, when the father is eliminated from being able to help the children, that's where part of the problem is, isn't it? Because there's only one parent, and often because of gender, the children are left with the most dysfunctional of their parents.
Yes, I mean, that's the tragedy. And because of in a sense, in the next 50 years, we're going to look back, and these last years from 71 onwards will be seen as the dark ages for the family.
Yes,
in the Western world.
Absolutely.
It really will.
And,
you know, I was at those huge collectives when the feminist movement were at its height in England, when it was at its most vociferous, and the launching of this destruction of the family. The family was not a safe place for women and children. The family had to be restructured, and the family had to call itself... women and children were the family unit. Men, women, and children were no longer acceptable. Men had to be disenfranchised from family life.
So you see yourself, the feminist movement has done, what, more harm than good, or...?
I think it's one of the most evil movements of this last century.
And yet you yourself are clearly highly intelligent and very successful woman.
I'm in a bed set on my pension because I've been bankrupted so often by this. I'm highly intelligent, but I'm not successful, no.
Are you generalising by saying that? Because surely that it must be just the radical feminists who are like that. You're saying that the feminist movement as a whole...
Is evil. Yeah, because the entire concept is evil.
Right.
Any movement that sets out to hate...
Yes.
As the feminist movement does. I mean, even down to the woman in the street who will say, I'm a feminist, what does she actually mean? She means she's derogatory about men.
But doesn't it mean, like, feminist, that she's basically, that they're pushing the women's cause? Not so much denigrating men, but elevating women. I mean, that's where...
But nobody needs to do that. I mean, you know, all of us who have children, who have brothers and uncles, and, you know, women hold up half the sky, but men hold up the other half.
So how have you managed personally to survive the level of vitriol that you've faced and to go on as you've done?
Faith, love of God, really. I'm a lover of God in all his aspects. I'm not comfortable with organized religions, but I absolutely passionately believe that I am loved and we are all loved. And I accepted very early on when I realized, and I'd actually come face to face with this movement, and I was thrown out. I was banned from all the collectives. Mm. I realized what I was taking on, and I knew it was going to be hard, and I knew it was going to be lonely, and it still is.
We're running out of time now. Can you just sum up for us what you've... I don't know how you could do it, but if you could sum up your experiences over time and what you would like to pass on.
I think sometime in most people's lives, they're faced with something they know that is evil. And they have a choice. You can either decide that it is your job to overcome this and to fight it through, or you can run away. And I chose to stand up and fight it. And what I feel now passionately when I'm talking to men is there has to be a consciousness raising among men that they are responsible for each other. There has to be a laying down of the swords. You know, the trouble is so many men are wounded warriors and they have to heal themselves before they go into battle. And the future for actually overthrowing this dreadful movement has to be in men's hands. They have to get together to fight for the sake of their children.
We've been talking with Erin Pitsey. She's one of the world's leading commentators on gender and the author of a number of books, including Prone to Violence, Scream Quietly or the Neighbours Will Hear You, and a number of other articles, including Domestic Violence is Not a Gender Issue. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been
bye-bye.
A great pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
The man's put us together.
next week we'll have Dr. Ludwig Lowenstein. He's one of the world's leading experts on parental alienation syndrome, and we'd very much like to thank Erin Pitsey for coming on the show. What a fantastic interview that was. Really interesting woman indeed, and we do hope to have her on again. We're just going to wind up looking at, as we did earlier, the Alec Baldwin case. This is Stephen Baskerville writing. He says, whatever his imperfections as a parent, Baldwin showed his daughter he cares enough about her to want to see her and be concerned about her. For children, such actions speak louder than words, even shouted words, and this relates so much to parental alienation syndrome. When we screw up, we have an opportunity to teach our children that humans make mistakes, wrote the author of The Mummy Chronicles, Martha Brockenbach. We can ask for forgiveness, we can do better in the future, and hope that when our children become parents themselves, they will have learned that we don't have to be perfect to be lovable, and that forgiveness is a gift that heals. And Baskerville finishes up his piece by saying, forgiveness is a principle that operates in the family, in religion, and in other personal relationships. The state does not forgive. The state only punishes, and the state is raising the next generation of citizens. And it's a very interesting article, and we hope to have Baskerville on again. Just to wind up, also a bit of a public notice here. The government has launched new Relationship Education Resource Package. The Minister for Family and Community Services and Indigenous Affairs, Mal Brough, has released a new resource to help families build stronger relationships called the Keys to Living Together Kit. Mal Brough has ignored all our requests to come on the program, but it'll be interesting to see if in an election year he may be a little bit more focused in his attention and decide that dads are voters also. We shall see. And we'll certainly be asking him on, or to clarify to our listeners whether he's refusing to come on to the world's longest running fathers program. That will be interesting to see. Anyway, Keys to Living Together was produced in direct response to demand from the community and the community services sector for material which can be used to help educators and individuals, families or couples build stronger relationships, Mr. Brough said. And there's a DVD and all sorts of other material, 900,000 copies. Think of the trees that have died for the cause of this, of the package have been produced and will be distributed to relationship education service providers. We'll be back next week. Don't forget Dr. Ludwig Lowenstein, the author of a new book, Parental Alienation Syndrome. We'll be back.